C2SP. Number 16B.
We don't know how this will come about, that we will see how error becomes, from the human standpoint, from the human belief standpoint, bigger and bigger, more powerful, more fearful, that we are constantly living as if we were sitting on a barrel of dynamite and never know when the barrel blows off, and can hardly see how suddenly when it reaches its zenith, then its nothingness will appear. I don't know how that will happen, but we have many indications how they can happen. If we consider only the last 70, 80 years in physics, we really can see how matter becomes more and more elusive. That what we believed at the beginning of the century to be hard-boiled matter, really substance matter which cannot be changed and that cannot be destroyed, even if you split it apart, it's still matter. And then to see that step by step, the physicists began to see the mental nature first of matter, began to see that matter is only a construct of the human mind, therefore seeing the mental nature of it. And when one has a little insight, though one doesn't really understand what really is happening, because it seems that only a few dozen really good top physicists know what really happens with the research now. But when one reads the articles and so on, one can see that something is happening there where matter just seems to disappear in illusion. And there may be just one or two or other big discoveries in that field, and perhaps that will change our whole attitude towards the material world. You know, already now they show that if two photons, that are the little particles of life, if they have once touched each other and then, prelled away or touched each other and left each other, that from that point on they will always be in communication. No matter what that photon millions of miles away is alone, and the other one other millions miles away from the other, they are still in relationship, that they are still behaving as they would know each other. You can see things are going to be seen now that show really the absolute elusiveness of matter. That what we call matter is not there at all, that it's really just a human concept which we held for a few millions a year, but that it is a false concept and there's no reality in itself. So we don't know what will happen with a new Einstein, with a new Schrödinger, with a new Planck, and so on. We don't know when they come. They come because it's in a line of development. They must come because the Christ idea is still at work, and we cannot, from our limited standpoint of human belief, see really what it will be the final trick and the final change that is necessary in order that we see the complete elusiveness of matter. And then we will wake up to a completely different world view. Then we have here, the nearer false belief approaches truth. You see, truth is here, a small t, without passing the boundary where, having been destroyed by divine science, it ceases to be even an illusion. The rivalry becomes for destruction. So even when first he is showing that that matter reaches its mortal zenith in illusions, and then she says if matter then even loses the aspect of being an illusion, then really it is ripe for complete destruction. So the more material the belief, the more obvious is then its error, until divine spirit, supreme in its domain, dominates all matter, and man is found in the likeness of spirit, his original being. So all this build-up of error to the mortal zenith of self-destruction, where it becomes an illusion, and then finally even the illusion goes, then we are entering really the spiritual realm, then man is found in the likeness of spirit, and that is his original state of being. This paragraph, therefore, is for us leading, so to say, for our world view, and should give us a kind of strength and a kind of assurance that what is going on today is not what we see with our eyes, that it is just something that is innate in a very old belief, but that it is breaking up. And that breaking up looks to be an increase of error, and that error becomes more potent, whereas in reality, error begins to give up its so-called and its assumed power. So the next paragraph, on the next subtone, namely, truth as truth. The more broadly truth is recognized, the more error displays its falsity. We have here a continuation of that trend of thought. The broadest facts, how she goes out from the facts before she was going out from error, simulating truth. Now she goes out from the facts, the broadest facts array the most falsities against themselves, for they bring error from undercover. That's what we always can see. The deeper we understand Christian Science, the more error is seen, because the more we understand the oldness of truth, then that brings from undercover error that we have never seen before. It brings from undercover traits of error, the unconscious error, the subconscious error, and all that comes up. And so it seems the more we know about truth, the more we have to deal with the suggestions of error. So it isn't so that the more I know about the truth that I am free from error, or that I have less to deal with error. It is the other way around. Because all that which I have not known to be error, because it lies in the subconscious, comes now to the surface, and I begin to realize new errors, more secret errors, more unconscious error, and so it brings from undercover more error. It requires, therefore, courage to utter truth. Again, it's a small t, to utter truth, for the higher truth, capital T, lifts her voice, the louder will error scream. Here we have it. Why does error scream so loud? It's only because the voice of truth is being spoken, is being known, and so error will scream, because error does not want to be destroyed by truth, until its inarticulate sound is forever silenced in oblivion. Until all the error, all the voice of error is silenced. So we get here the demand or the command not to shut up, when error screams, but to stand to truth and voice the truth, no matter how loud error screams and seems to say the very opposite and seems to make ridicule of truth, the more we have to stand to truth, to our conviction, and voice it. Until its inarticulate sound is forever silenced in oblivion. Yes. Then a last subtone, just a small one. All matter then disappears before the supremacy of spirit. We really get here a climax now, a spiritual climax. Namely, he uttered his voice, the earth melted. We can see he uttered his voice, truth. What happens then? The earth melted, matter melted. This scripture indicates that all matter will disappear before the supremacy of spirit. So this is a resume, this is a climax or a zenith of the whole tone of truth that says, well, matter will disappear before the supremacy of spirit. Matter has no chance to be victorious, to win the case, if we stick to our guns and are courageous enough to stand for truth, then error will disappear. And matter yields to the supremacy of spirit, which solves the whole subject of spiritualism. So matter will disappear before the supremacy of spirit is one of the very few statements she makes up to here in the textbook, showing that matter is not a reality, that matter is not a factor to take into account, that it disappears, that it is nothing. That's the whole tone of truth. Now, we can see that the whole tone of truth, if you want to recapitulate it quickly and go over it and say, well, what is it really saying, then we see that our main epitome may be quite clear, namely that through conscious spiritualization. Now, up to now, we always had an epitome that started out with spiritualization demands this and demands that and the other. Here we could see that spiritualization demands really a conscious spiritualization, that we have that we don't have just to drift and take each day as it comes and live our life just the way it happens, but that we are consciously really being in command of our life and command our life through truth. So that the conscious spiritualization brings the end of error, and this we have seen. Constantly she speaks here about the end of error, that we should welcome the end of error until the nothingness of error appears, until the end of error again, until the errors of belief yield, that matter is nothingness, and it will the nothingness of matter will appear, that error is forever silenced in oblivion, that all matter will disappear. You have really a tabula rasa here that just wipes out error and makes a clean plate, and a clean table, and a clean plate, and says, only truth is reigning. That's the point, naturally, then, of spiritualization. That's why he says, then spiritualization will follow, the final spiritualization of all things will appear, so that man is found in the likeness of spirit, his original being. So this is the undercurrent tone in this chapter. Now, through the seven subtones we have seen, and I recapitulate the seven subtones in just my words as they come to me now, but tonality-wise, correct. Namely, that she says, how on earth can we work so that the end of error, of all error, will come about? And the very first point she says is naturally mind, that you said, well, it all depends on your mentality, on your mind. What kind of mind do you have? Do you have a closed mind or do you have an open mind? Do you have a mind that is ignorant and does not want to be instructed? Or do you have a mind that is based on knowledge, on apprehension, on research, on investigation? Is that the mind you have? So she says the very first thing that we can consciously entertain is that we welcome every new knowledge, that we welcome the increase of knowledge, even the increase of invention, well knowing that this is only a transitionary stage, that will finally give place to not a higher technology, but to spiritual being, to spiritual reality. As a second step in our conscious work about bringing about the end of error is to take always the side of spirit and always to work in the spiritual line of things to the final spiritualization of all things, even if it brings about fermentation, if the material routine is broken up by it, even if there will be conflicting forces fighting an enormous battle, even if it brings the disturbances that will continue the breaking up of material beliefs, even if the false foundations are shaken and there is a mental fermentation taking place or a moral chemicalization taking place, you stick with spirit. You take the side of spirit. And so if you take the side of spirit always, no matter what's going to happen in the material world, then you will be on the sides of science and peace, and no more on the signs of dismay and discord. Then a third step is necessary. Having taken the side of spirit, soul says, now you have to stick to that side of spirit and not vacillate between spirit and matter, constantly like a pendulum swinging between two opposites. You have to be a sticker, you have to endure until the end, you have to remain steadfast in spiritual understanding. And as a force, she says, and with that spiritual understanding, you should do something. This you should use as your principle to demonstrate really the nothingness of error by keeping crime in check. You have to handle evil consciously, and not just put evil under the carpet and sweep it under the carpet and say, well, I don't bother about it. I only want to do something to do with the spiritual, with the divine. Animal magnetism is nothing, and this is not really holding crime in check. So holding crime in check will then be explained in the next chapter on animal magnetism uncovered. She takes a whole chapter to show that. But here is the first command and say, look here, this is your job. Don't leave it to the politicians, don't leave it to the military people, don't leave it to anyone. You do it. So the Christian scientist is defined here as the one who really does the work and handles animal magnetism. Another point, truth as life, then shows that in the course of this error and of the fermentation and crisis that goes on, you should see that you are not getting fooled by error. You keep your head cool and you see that the more error seems to be able to simulate truth and do the works of God, and perhaps even doing it better than God, in any case doing it better than you with your human brain, don't think that this is the way that the idea will develop. So the nearer error simulates really truth, the nearer it is to self-destruction, the more impotent it becomes. So don't be fooled by what you see. You have to see through it and see what is going on behind the scene. And behind the scene, naturally, is something going on that brings about the self-destruction of error. That error only gets bigger and bigger in order to be able to destroy itself. Not that error can become bigger and bigger to build up something terrific, to build up the Tower of Babel, or anything like that. It will not reach heaven. It will confound itself, and it will be resolved first, a matter into illusion, and then finally you give up the illusion, and then you see that you have done something very constructive. You have then found your original being in spirit. In that course of the self-destruction, naturally, error doesn't like to be destroyed. It screams, it voices louder and louder the beliefs of error. And at that point, truth says to us, then you also have to voice truth. And you voice it fearlessly so that you are not overwhelmed by the voice of error, and error, step by step, will shut up. It will scream no more. That's then the point when error has no sayings anymore, where it no more utters its suggestions, where it has no more a belief, where it does no more say, where does error come from? It's shut out. It is no more a factor. That's the point of solution. That's the point of love, where all matter disappears under the supremacy of spirit. And all that is left is the supremacy of spirit. That wipes away, wipes out, really, spiritualism. That's the tone of truth. It's a very practical tone for us. It is interesting that all the time one would have hoped or would have longed or had the desire that we would say to ourselves, I only wish Mrs. Eddy would have given us some kind of a prophecy, what's going to happen in the future, and not knowing that she really did it. But in this whole tone of truth, and then afterwards when we take the main tone of love, she has really pointed out what will happen after the discovery of Christian Science. And we have not seen it because we have never studied it in its context, those sentences in its context, never have related sentences with sentences, paragraph with paragraph, subject with subject, and so we just through those, I always call that damn lesson sermon, people have been educated into ignorance, always thinking about isolated ideas. The lesson sermons were wonderful 100 years ago, but that was 100 years ago. Who would go into the school 100 years ago? Who would go into a university that was teaching the same thing as 100 years ago? Who would do such a silly thing? Nobody that has any kind of brain and reason in his head would do such a thing. The lesson sermons were the best for that time because people didn't know what to read and how to read. So they were forced to read something about in a according a straight line about the subject, but those lesson sermons do not interpret the textbook. They don't show what the textbook is. It is like a nice, big, wonderful cake, and you only pick out some nuts out of it and chew them over and over and over. You chew them over a lifetime, always the same 25 nuts. But the whole cake you leave untouched. Yes. And everybody forgets that Mrs. Eddy left it in his trust that you can read, that she said that if the time is comes that it has to be changed, you can change them. That nobody really wants to know. Lesson sermon. In this way, can you see, one never could be able to see what really the teaching of Christian Science is. And only could see what the lesson sermon committee had in mind and was bringing out. That's all. So let's be not unwilling to learn all things right, she says. That's the point. The truth in mind, she said, that unwillingness to learn all things right really binds Christendom with change. When the time is ripe, we really should see that we go on. That at her time, nobody was able to think in categories, nobody was able to think structurally. One did not even know that is such a thing as structure, as a scientific tool. So one did the best at that time. But today, when the whole world is constantly screaming of structure, structuralism, of dimensionalism, of system and of matrix and so on, there we must be on our toes and be progressive and open up our consciousness and say, I go forward, I accept the forward steps as long, naturally, as we can prove it through the textbook, not otherwise. And so we always try to prove everything what we teach through the textbook, and through the consistency and coherency of the structure of the textbook. We never deviate from the textbook. We never say, well, we only take the nice nuts out of the cake of the textbook and all the rest we leave behind. We never touch it. That's why so many Christian scientists have never really touched the fourth chapter, Christian Science versus Spiritualism, just with a nice remark, I'm not a spiritualist, therefore I'm not interested in the chapter. Well, I hope I have shown up to now in this week that we are all spiritualists, that this is actually the fundamental question that has to be resolved. It's a question of dualism that has been a yoke since many thousand years for human thinking, since we came out of the mystical thinking and the mystical age into the rational age with the Greek period. Logic has been the ruling measuring rod for our thinking, but that measuring rod was dualistic. It had a two-valued logic, whereas science has a one-valued logic.